Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Yesterday was primary day, of course. The races have narrowed down now. We look forward to the general election in November. We're going to get your reaction. Were you pleased or displeased? Did your candidate win? What are the issues that were of special importance for you during the primaries and looking ahead to the general election? And phone lines will be open throughout this hour, and we'll be checking email as well. That's 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495, or upraxis@gmail.com, upraxis@gmail.com. We'll be talking with several candidates, winners and losers, in this half of the program a little later on. We're talking with Donna McAleer, who won the Democratic nomination for the 1st Congressional District. Ryan Combe, her opponent, also be with us. And we'll be talking with Sean Reyes, who lost to John Swallow in the Attorney General's race for the Republican nomination. Later on in the second half, we'll be talking with activists and candidates who are dissatisfied with the current system. We'll be talking with Pat Rosensteel from the National Popular Vote Movement. They want to bypass the Electoral College. We'll conclude the program talking with former Salt Lake City Mayor Rocky Anderson, who's running for president on third-party tickets, whether he just won the Peace and Freedom Party nomination for California for president yesterday. We begin with political analysts, Deseret News columnist Frank Pignanelli and LeVar Webb. Gentlemen, welcome back to the program.
Hello. Good to be with you.
Thank you so much for taking some time to be with us. Pretty good turnout, gentlemen. I think most of us have to be pleased with that. In fact, even better than 2008, beginning with LeVar Webb. To what do you attribute that?
Certainly there were some big races. Mitt Romney at the top of the ticket, although everyone, that was a foregone conclusion. But the U.S. Senate race, there were lots of more television advertising, radio advertising probably than in many primary elections, and so that brought the people out. Obviously, it was a good turnout for the Republicans, above 30%. In most cases, Democrats were, it was a tiny turnout in most districts because in many cases they didn't have anyone on the ballot, but a good turnout for the Republicans.
And Frank Pignanelli, good turnout, especially for Republicans.
Well, it was better than expected. What it does show is that there is obviously a great deal of support for Romney. I mean, they all knew that he was going to be the nominee, but they still want to come out and support him. But it also shows that there was a lot of interest in some of these other races too. So there's active interest inside the Republican Party.
Mitt Romney gets more than 90% of the Republican vote. I guess no big surprise there. Are there any lessons at all we can draw from that, Mr. Pignanelli?
Well, I guess the lesson is that when you had, overwhelming numbers showing up to go vote for Romney, and it's over 90%, number one, he had to get over 90%. Otherwise, there would have been this bizarre conversation, is he losing support amongst his base? So we're all grateful that he got over 90% so we can avoid that stupid discussion across the country. But what it also shows is the Democrats need to have a message, because Romney's likely to have very strong coattails. And so the Democrats up and down the state who are running in November need to have a message as to why Utahns who are going to vote for Romney, why they need to cross over and vote for them.
Mr. Webb, do you agree with that? Romney will have strong coattails. It's likely to buoy up Republican candidates.
Yes, I do. And given the turnout, and a lot of that was to support Romney, I think that is verified. It's a little bit surprising to me that Ron Paul didn't get a little more, and maybe it's only because if you monitor Republican Facebook groups and chat groups and so forth, the Ron Paul people are just all over the place, and you would think reading those things that Ron Paul has a lot of support in the state, and yet he got less than 5% of the vote, 4.5%. So despite how vocal they are, there really aren't very many people who support Ron Paul.
Let's turn to the Senate race. Orrin Hatch wins comfortably, beginning with Mr. Webb. What are your reaction to, and this is a sentiment which would be shared by some others, but I'm reading from the Salt Lake Tribune editorial board from today's paper. They're saying that they're taking this as evidence that the Tea Party influence has ebbed, and they say good riddance.
If you take what has happened in the election to this point with the convention and now the primary, clearly the major Tea Party candidates lost, and so Tea Party is clearly on the ebb in Utah. Although Lindquist capitalized on the Tea Party sentiment and those who were against incumbents and the what's going on in Washington, but I don't know that he would ever really classify himself as a hardcore Tea Party type. He's I think he's more practical than that. And I think despite the fact that he lost big, I mean, there are lots of reasons for it. Orrin Hatch with all of his money, big name ID, and all of that, I think Lindquist still has a bright political future. I think he's an up-and-coming politician and should look to do something in the future.
And Mr. Pignanelli, any particular lessons we can draw from this senatorial primary?
Well, I mean, I would say that the Tea Party's got real issues, real problems, not so much from the Orrin Hatch race, although that was a big deal, because what Orrin Hatch had done, he was able to demonize FreedomWorks and some of the other Tea Party organizations, which was very important. So that's one lesson to be learned, is you go out and you know, in advance, you go after the special interest organizations who are coming after you, not so much the candidate. And Orrin Hatch's folks did a great job with that. Where the Tea Party has got their problems between the convention, but also look at the legislative races this year, this primary. You had some major Tea Party activists who went down, against fellow Republicans, whether it was Casey Anderson losing in Cedar City or you had David Butterfield losing up in Logan. So they've got some real problems, the Tea Party does. Now, that doesn't mean they're completely dead, but they are definitely on life support. And so from the top of the ballot to the bottom of the ballot, that's a lesson to be learned, too. Also in the Senate race, what demonstrated is that Orrin Hatch started campaigning on this thing a year and a half ago. He focused on making sure that he separated the Utahns from the Tea Party movement, saying they're not us, it's not what we're all about. And it really was a demonstration. The other thing is that he caught on early, if you're going to deal with the delegates, you better go in there and make sure that you're in there and either you identify delegates you support or you get them to support you or you get someone to run against a delegate. So he has done a masterful job of putting together what I think is probably the premier campaign for a long time to come for people to look at, the model campaign.
Mr. Webb, Mr. Pignanelli mentioned some of those legislative races and some surprises there. What particularly stood out to you from some of those legislative races?
I agree with Frank. Some of the Tea Party candidates lost and took on incumbents that, I mean, there were some other interesting races as well where two incumbents ended up in one district, and I don't know that there was an overwhelming pattern to what happened there. Races still come down to how well they're run, who the candidates are, and how capable and competent they are, how they project themselves, and so there were local factors in these races as well. It wasn't one overarching theme that kind of controlled all of them. But people were not voting for the Tea Party, clearly.
Mm. Frank Pugnelli, the Attorney General race, the Republican nomination there, the particularly nasty race, Mr. Swallow ended up winning quite handily. Were there any particular issues there, or was this just a case of a particularly nasty campaign?
Well, yeah, it was a nasty campaign, and supporters of both sides were nasty. What I found fascinating about this campaign is that Sean Race is a very competent attorney and had done a nice job of reaching out to the legal community and probably has support of the majority of the legal community. But what John Swallow had done is, number one, he had capitalized on the popularity of Mark Shurtleff. But he, while there was this battle of who's the most qualified, John Swallow went out and said, look, I'm going to take care of the public lands issues. I'm going to do this. You know, he really hit on the heartstrings. And I think he and John Dougal, who also did this in the state auditor's race, went beyond just qualified, but they said, I'm going to go after these issues. And so I believe it's set a new standard there. I mean, Sean Ray should have done better based upon his background and where he was, the downtown law firm support. But John Swallow touched the heartstrings. Now, John Swallow has been involved in campaigns before and things like that, but he touched something with Republican voters in a race that normally doesn't get that much attention.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Pignanelli, the auditor's race, particularly interesting, and some are pointing out that the winner there, John Dougal, isn't a CPA, and are saying is he qualified to be auditor, state auditor?
This is a classic example of us saying, is, yeah, John Dougal's not a CPA, but he was saying, wait a minute, we need more than just auditing. We need a complete review of how the state's being managed. And he took it to this to a different level. And so in this current environment, is government working or not? He said, we will go and we will dive to find out how much of how government's working, more than just what an accountant would do. We're going to make sure that it's being managed well. That really touched the heartstrings of our Republican voters. He had a very clever campaign. Austin Johnson is a very competent person, but he was outgunned. I mean, it's not that John Dougal had a lot of money. He was just clever with the frugal Dougal and using the social media and things like that. And I believe it's set. You see this in the county races and the local races, where oftentimes a person with the more degrees loses to somebody that has a little more clever strategy. But now we've seen in a statewide basis that you can campaign for an office without necessarily traditional qualifications. But yet, if you have some type of idea of how that office should operate that's different, you can win that race.
LeVar Webb, I wonder, in a couple of cases, and we talked with a couple of people yesterday on the program in a short segment, Constitution Party had a nomination race. A party like that normally wouldn't. The Democrats in the 1st Congressional District had a nomination race. Is that usual indication of growing strength in a party or not?
It is an indication of growing strength. The Constitution Party is so small that they're really not a factor, and they would have been smarter probably to spread their candidates around among other races rather than have a primary. For the Democrats, I think it's healthy to have a primary. This is certainly lifted in the fact that Mrs. McAleer, I can't remember her first name.
Donna,
won by such a big margin and has generated some visibility and publicity for the Democrats in that first congressional district. So I think it's a positive thing for them up there. She'll obviously have a very difficult time against Congressman Bishop. But when you do have a number of candidates going after a seat, it does indicate interest and a strength of a party.
I'm particularly interested, and I think a lot of people are, in the race between incumbent Congressman Jim Matheson and the Republican Mia Love. Mia Love is getting a lot of buzz nationally. The latest poll that came out showed Mr. Matheson with a fairly comfortable lead. Do you, starting with Mr. Webb on this, do you expect that will tighten up by November?
I do expect it will tighten up. Name ID and past history is a big deal, especially this early in the campaign. And despite the fact that Mia Love has received a fair amount of publicity, people that are really paying attention tend to be those politicos who are highly interested, and the general public isn't paying much attention. So the fact that Jim Matheson has been around forever, everyone knows him. He's been popular, well-liked. I would expect that he would be well ahead at this point in the campaign. But there's 4 months left and plenty of time for Mia Love to catch up. And I do think that this will be a very close race. And I do give Mia Love a reasonable chance to win it, unlike perhaps past Republican races against Jim Matheson. I think she has a very realistic chance of winning, especially with Mitt Romney at the top of the ticket.
Frank Pugnelli, do you share that view? This district is a somewhat more Republican, I believe. Who do you think wins there?
Well, let's say it's the least Republican of all the four, which means it's probably somewhere around 60%, which was one of the reasons why Jim Matheson chose to run there. Look, Mia Love's going to be a tough candidate because, for several reasons. Obviously, it's a Romney coattail. Secondly, she is an attractive figure. Look what happened. I mean, everyone predicted a primary coming out of that convention, and she just, she decimated her opposition, and she had strong opposition from the conservative side. And so, therefore, you have to give her that credit. Now, Jim Matheson, Orrin Hatch is a good campaigner, but so is Jim Matheson. And Jim, like Orrin, has taken nothing for granted. The difficulty that Jim is going to have, but he'll get around it, is that Mia Love has said things that are very Tea Party-like and has taken positions that very much in court of the Tea Party. So, to be honest, it's always tough to run against a woman because you want to make sure that you're not being a bully. But if he can put her in that box, that she's just another Tea Party crony, then Jim should do just fine, even in the prevailing Romney landslide.
Well, we've reached the end of the segment. We'll, I'm sure, have you gentlemen back on previewing the fall elections. Very interesting results from yesterday, and now focusing on the November elections, which will include Mitt Romney, of course, is the presidential candidate for the Republicans. He got over 90% of the vote yesterday in the presidential election for the Republicans in the primary yesterday. Frank Pignanelli, LeVar Webb, a pleasure as always. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, glad to help. Bye-bye.
And we're going to continue this discussion with several candidates in the next segment. Donna McAleer, Ryan Comby, and Sean Reyes will be joining us to talk about their experience in this primary election and the race so far. We'll be asking you, we are asking you to call in with what issues are at the top of your list. What candidates you're pushing, what you're looking for the November election, what your experience was in choosing in the primary election. The number is 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495, or upraxis@gmail.com, upraxis@gmail.com. Later on in the second half of the program, we'll be joined by USU Associate Professor of Political Science Mike Lyons, and he and I will canvas the landscape for people who aren't satisfied with the current system and are working outside of it. That includes former Salt Lake City Mayor Rocky Anderson. He'll be joining us in about half an hour from now to talk about his presidential campaign. And he's not campaigning on the Republican or Democratic ticket. And we'll also be talking with Pat Rosensteel from the National Popular Vote Movement. That's all coming up. Right now, we bring in Blue. This is on line three. Make sure we have the right line here. Donna McAleer, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom.
And congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Were you surprised by the margin of victory?
We're thrilled with the margin of victory. I think we built on the momentum from the convention and just took it through this primary. I mean, it shows that a lot of people are paying attention, are involved, are willing to get engaged. I think it was a energetic campaign. My opponent ran a clever and energetic campaign and brought a lot of people out to the polls. So we're thrilled, and we are planning on just moving this forward and taking it through November.
And I assume our listeners are very engaged and know, but just a reminder, Donna McAleer now is the Democratic nominee in the 1st Congressional District. She'll take on Congressman Rob Bishop in the fall, defeating Ryan Comby in the election. A Park City resident, I believe?
Yes.
So what do you think were the issues that resonated most in this primary?
I think the issues that resonated most are proven pragmatic leadership. I think people are very disappointed and frankly tired of career politicians, of obstructionism and gridlock. And they're ready for a change. They're ready for elected legislators who bring a record of results from business, from not-for-profit, from other areas of life, not career politicians. So I think that was really big. And I think the other thing that was really big is we have three great assets of this state. First and foremost, the strength of our families, our public lands, and our natural resources. People are really, really interested in how do we strengthen our education, how do we protect access to public lands, and how do we develop energy responsibly and in a sustainable way and take advantage of our fossil base and continue to invest in our alternative and our renewable base.
This is, I'm sure you know, historically a pretty Republican district. Do you like your chances?
I do. I'm thrilled. We are, you know, getting people out. And I think in the voters I've talked to, the thousands of voters I've talked to throughout this district and frankly throughout the country, I think many people are somewhere in between, right? They're And there's no one candidate or no one party that represents completely everybody's issues. And we have rigid ideology and extreme thinkers in both parties. And I think people are looking for leaders who are willing to work together, work collaboratively and cooperatively, and move our state and move our country forward.
Well, thank you very much. Donna McAleer is the Democratic nominee now, having won the primary. She'll take on Congressman Rob Bishop in the fall.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We bring in now Sean Reyes, who ran for the Republican nomination for Attorney General. Mr. Reyes, thank you.
Hi. Is this Tom?
Yes. Appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Wanted to bring in some candidates, whether successful or not, in the primaries. It is quite the experience running for office. Is this the first time for you running for office?
That's right. Well, we feel successful, even though the results didn't go our way. We were excited about the campaign that we ran, and it is my first foray into running for political office.
And this was, by all accounts, you call it tough. Some people called it dirty. How would you characterize this campaign?
Sure, pretty intense, pretty tough, and I would even say dirty at times. So, I think all of those things are apropos.
Has this soured you on running for office again in the future, or will we see you running again?
Well, I don't know if I'll run again, but I'll definitely leave those options open. I guess I am disappointed a bit in the process, particularly with the participation of the Super PAC and the malicious ads that they ran. Disappointed that it hijacks the election in many ways away from the focus of what's most important or what should be most important to the voters. And also, outside of trying to win the election, one of my secondary goals was to get more people who historically perhaps haven't participated in politics more involved, those who are business leaders, those who are so involved in their businesses and service, whether that be civically or church and with their families, that they haven't had time for politics. And so I think we made a lot of strides to that end and got a lot of people throughout the state excited about politics. But then when this happened, many of them said, you know, this is the reason why we're jaded about politics to begin with. This is why, you know, good people don't run. This is the worst of politics. And so, like I said, disappointing that way, but not with my campaign. We're thrilled with, all of the support that we had up and down the state, and with our message about, returning the office to be one primarily a law office rather than a political office. And also we ran with a great deal of positive energy and integrity and honor throughout the whole campaign. So that's why I'm excited and happy right now and can turn my focus to serving in other ways throughout the community and throughout the state.
It's interesting. I want to follow up. You said you were trying to reach out to people, trying to maybe get them in for the first time to the system, and that some people are sort of jaded and depressed about how the system is, and a lot of people are trying to figure out how to fix that. And now, having run for office and sort of been on both sides of that, do you have any ideas? Do we need reform of these super PACs? Do we need reform in other areas? How to get people excited again about the process?
Sure, I think we can probably look at some mechanisms to provide more transparency. I think that's all that people want. Again, you know, political campaigns are hard-fought, heated, contested, and we don't mind, I don't think the candidates mind, people making aggressive comparisons about records and credentials and qualifications. But when an outside entity can come in and inject out-and-out lies and influence a race that way, I think that's what sets people, turns them sour. And so I'd be open, very open, to having more transparency and more accountability for these types of entities.
What are the issues, do you think, that have got people excited as we look toward November?
Well, certainly the economy is the preeminent issue, both at a presidential and national level and at a local level, and that the economy touches on a lot of things, public lands and how that would play into our economy. The health care issue, and we're awaiting that historic decision right now on the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. Those things are big, and as I've come up and down the state, immigration is still a very intense topic that's on a lot of people's minds. But again, I think the economy, and I'd probably be joined by most political experts and pundits saying that is the issue du jour.
Mm-hmm. Are you endorsing Mr. Swallow now?
I did. I called him last mm-hmm. night to congratulate John and his family and his team, and am endorsing him in this race.
Mm-hmm. Well, good luck to you in your future endeavors. Appreciate you coming on with us today.
Well, thanks so much, Tom, and you have a great day, and I wish my best to all the other candidates and congratulate everybody, regardless of the results last night, who put themselves out there and ran.
Yeah, important that we have candidates to run. Thank you. John Reyes, Attorney General candidate, lost to Mr. Swallow in yesterday's election, and will be... Of course, following this, we'll have debates on Utah Public Radio featuring many of the major races and, of course, coverage continuing right up to Election Day. Following a brief break, and we'll have a Thad Box commentary, I'll be joined by USU Associate Professor of Political Science Mike Lyons. We're going to take a little bit of a different perspective turn in the second half of the program. We'll be talking to some people who are dissatisfied with the present system. Mr. Reyes there said he had been talking to some people who had a bit of a dissatisfaction with the current system. We'll be talking with Pat Rosensteel from National Popular Vote Movement. They want to bypass the Electoral College and elect a president based solely on popular vote. Then we'll be talking with former Salt Lake City Mayor Rocky Anderson, who is running for president, but not as a Republican or a Democrat. In fact, he was involved with Americans Elect movement, and just yesterday he won the California primary for the Peace and Freedom Party. He's dissatisfied with the current system. We'll ask him why. That's coming up in the next half of the program.
Commentator Thad Box.
At the Gardener's Market in Logan, people gather each week, visiting, assuring one another that the good life starts with Mother Earth. Men and women stand in self-forming groups and talk about their heirloom tomatoes. They share ideas for protecting seedlings and keeping gardens safe from blight, insects, birds, and predators. The celebration of Mother Earth is present in female and male alike. Farmers' markets were almost extinct a decade ago, but in the late 1900s, local markets began to grow again. Now you find them in Salt Lake City, Logan, Moab, Paradise, almost any little town. Their resurrection began as a place to buy fresh, healthy food. Then they became a venue where people go to understand themselves, their relationship to others, and their kinship to the land. Aldo Leopold argued that humans are part of the land. He wrote that all ethics rest on the premise that the individual is a member of a community of interdependent parts. He taught that a land ethic reflects a conviction of individual responsibility for the health of the land. It changes all of us from conquerors of the land community to plain members and citizens of it. No one at the Gardener's Market last Saturday was alive when logging crews from Cache Valley hauled the last logs large enough to make a railroad tie from the mountains that surround us. Nor can anyone remember the dust clouds rising from nomadic bands of sheep as they buried the mountains of vegetation. A few may remember how local people bought land and gave it to the Forest Service to protect our valleys. But most people at the Gardener's Market have never grown corn, they've never harvested beans for the winter. But I heard optimism in their voices. They were not conquerors of the earth, but people trying to be part of the land. This is Thad Box.
Thanks for joining us, or staying with us, I should say, for Access Utah. We're talking politics, obviously. We have gotten reaction to the primary elections of yesterday, looking forward to the fall. Our focus in this half of the program is on movements, activists, people who are dissatisfied in some way with the current system. Later in this half hour, we'll be talking with former Salt Lake City Mayor Rocky Anderson, who's running for president on various third-party tickets. He won the, let me pull up his website here and get this right, I think it's the Peace and Freedom Party vote for California just yesterday. He was running on the Americans Elect movement. We'll talk about that as well with Mr. Anderson. But right now we bring in Pat Rosenstiel from the National Popular Vote Movement. Mr. Rosenstiel, thank you for joining us.
Oh, grateful to be here. Thanks so much for the time.
I should acknowledge in studio here, returning to the microphones, USU Associate Professor of Political Science, Mike Lyons. Thanks
glad
for joining us.
You, Tom.
So, Mr. Rosenstiel, as I understand it, the National Popular Vote Movement, in essence, would provide for the election of president based on popular vote, not on the Electoral College.
That's sort of mostly right. I mean, what National Popular Vote does is it creates an agreement amongst the states, leveraging Article 2, Section 1, that allows states to award electors in any manner they deem is in the best interest of their state. So it's an agreement amongst the states. When enough states totaling 270 electoral votes pass the same piece of legislation, they agree in bloc to award their electors to the candidate who wins the most popular votes in all 50 states. So the Electoral College would still meet. The state power under Article 2, Section 1 would still be preserved, but enough states would say it's in their best interest to award their electors to the candidate who wins the most popular votes in all 50 states, which, of course, makes a vote in Utah matter as much to presidents as a vote in, say, battleground Ohio. Mm. That's what the National Popular Vote is, and it does guarantees the presidency through the Electoral College to the candidate who gets the most popular votes in all 50 states, and makes a vote in Utah always as important as a vote in battleground Ohio, and therefore we think might be in the best interest of Utah. We're going after the winner-take-all rule here, which is a state statute. We're not going after the Electoral College, which, of course, is an important principle of federalism, preserving the state power to award electors.
So the Electoral College would remain. It would just you'd go to proportional, not winner-take-all.
It would go, all of Utah's electors would go to the candidate who wins the most popular votes in all 50 states, along with other states who join the agreement. So
I
it wouldn't
see.
Be
yes.
proportional, but it would guarantee the presidency to the candidate through the Electoral College, guarantee the presidency to the candidate who gets the most popular votes in all 50 states.
And Professor Lyons, this would definitely, I think you were saying, benefit small states like Utah.
Well, it would benefit one-party states like Utah. I'm not sure it would benefit all small states. For example, New Mexico is a small state, but it's a competitive state that does receive quite a bit of attention from candidates currently. The National Popular Vote Movement impresses me with its ingenuity, and it certainly would magnify the importance of Utah relative to the treatment Utah currently receives. People say, well, Utah would cast fewer than 1% of all the votes cast nationally, and that's true. But the Electoral College creates the illusion that Utah has power when in reality it is almost completely overlooked. It's nothing more than a flyover state.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Rosenstiel, this is the whole point, right? Most of the country is sort of flyover states if they're sort of a one-party state, paid attention to.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, I didn't mean to talk over you, but that's exactly the point. I mean, right now we're facing a presidential election. If you look at sort of any of the coverage, they're all, every pundit, everybody involved with any of the campaigns is talking about the nine states that matter. They're only polling in nine states to determine what issues are important to those voters. And the rest of us, you know, 225 million Americans, I happen to live in, you know, pretty reliably blue Minnesota. You guys live in reliably red, meaning Republican Utah. The rest of us, 225 million Americans, are left on the sidelines. We're not being polled by our commander-in-chief. During their first terms to determine what policies are important. Presidents are getting transactional with persuadable audiences in states like Ohio just because they happen to be closely divided. And sort of issues that are important to voters in Utah are absolutely ignored by the president of the United States because his job is to get reelected. That's just the nature of politics. So certainly the point, there are real policy implications. It's not just about where the campaign spending is being done. Routinely, presidents are siding with Colorado over Utah on land use issues, right? And it's because Colorado is a closely divided battleground state and Utah is a reliably Republican state. We think that's not in the best interest of Utah. We think it's not in the best interest of the country. We believe that every voter in every state should matter in every presidential election, and national popular vote does that.
What progress are you making? What's the goal? I believe the goal is to get to enough states to agree to this so that you get to the 270?
Right. As soon as that state, anytime there are states totaling 270 electoral votes in the compact on or before July 20th or on July 20th of a presidential year, then national popular vote becomes the governing system with which we elect the president. So right now, we have nine states that have passed and signed through the sovereign will of their legislatures and governors the national popular vote bill. Those total 134 electoral votes, so we're halfway to where we need to be. We've been in Utah and have huge champions and Howard Stevenson and Mike Noel and bipartisan support throughout the state of Utah. And we're hoping during the next, 85 calendar days, or maybe it's only 45 calendar days, your legislative session, We're hopeful we can get Utah to exercise, its sovereign right to join, and we are certainly hopeful that 2012 is the last presidential election where 225 million Americans are left on the sidelines.
Mm-hmm. Professor, you were saying you admire the movement's ingenuity, energy. Do you think it's going to be successful?
I agree with the movement's objectives. They are exactly right to say that this is about more than the campaign. There are real policy consequences to this. And if Mitt Romney is elected as president, his logic in seeking reelection will be little different than that of Barack Obama. Obviously, he'll be a Republican, but he'll focus on those perennially competitive states like Colorado, Virginia, Ohio, Florida. It's a familiar list. And Utah will be neglected, as it has been, and California will be neglected because California is so solidly Democratic. So I'm wholeheartedly in agreement with the objectives of the movement. It does get tougher once you have, say, 200 electoral votes worth of states involved in the compact, because many states benefit from the status quo. They recognize this. Many states that might not currently be beneficiaries because they're not red or blue, and they're not competitive, they're somewhere in a gray area in between, some of those states might perceive that they could become competitive in the future and therefore benefit from the Electoral College. So it is going to be difficult to get to 270 votes. But I wish the movement the best.
And Mr. Rosenstiel, you are confident you can get to that 270?
Yeah, when I started this about 5 years ago, didn't start the movement, but got involved. I came to the issue as a conservative skeptic. To be honest with you, that's sort of what my politics is. And I needed to dig into it from a constitutional policy and political perspective, but. As soon as I did that, I understood what we were doing versus what we weren't doing, right? And am a full-throated supporter now. I think when I started, my mindset was, if this happens, this is going to be amazing. Now it's when this happens. There isn't any question but that the public wants this sort of change. I mean, public opinion polls say that's, more than 70% of the voters in this country sort of agree with our position on this issue. Legislators, it's one of those issues where, your biggest impediment to momentum is that it's change, right? And nobody likes change, and certainly they don't like it for change's sake. But as we move around the country, as we visit with legislators, as we brief virtually every legislator in every state we go to, I think the founders got it right by leaving this decision to legislators, because at the end of the day, they understand that voters in battleground states receive preferential presidential treatment. You know, they understand that their states, you know, generally speaking, are ignored by the commander-in-chief and sort of candidates that, you know, sort of seek that position. And generally they take serious the sovereign and sort of exclusive power left to them in the Constitution as a state right to do what's in the best interest of their state. And there isn't any doubt but that national popular vote is in the better interest of two-thirds of the states that are constantly flyover. There isn't any doubt but that NPV is in the better interest of those states than the current system of winner-take-all rules. And so, you know, pressure over time, we've been at this since 2005. This is not a reaction to the Clinton-Gore election. We started this movement in 2005. We're halfway there. We've passed 31 legislative chambers in 29 states, and we keep coming back for more because, you know, the current system should be indicted. It is indictable, and legislators ought to do what's in the best interest of their states and the constituents they represent. And by and large, that's what we find legislators are interested in doing on both sides of the aisle. This isn't a Democratic movement. It isn't a Republican movement. It isn't an independent movement. This is a movement for anybody, sort of Republican, Democrat, or independent, who believes there's a better way to elect the president.
Pat Rosenstiel from the National Popular Vote Movement. Thank you so much. By the way, the website, nationalpopularvote.com. Thank you.
Happy to do it. Thanks so much for having us. Happy to come back anytime.
All right. National Popular Vote Movement. And we bring in now presidential candidate, former Salt Lake City Mayor Rocky Anderson. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
We're talking in this half of the hour on the movements and candidates who are dissatisfied with the current system. I believe we could safely put you in that category. Why are you running not as a Republican, not as a Republican? Or Democrat or Republican?
You mean as a Democrat?
Yes, sorry.
Because those two parties have together created this incredible political duopoly, which has degraded our democracy, has made it impossible for third parties or independent candidates to run. And in governing, they've completely betrayed the public interest. They are both feeding from the same trough of special interest money. They're both on the take. They have both created the system where it takes many millions of dollars to run for office. And then once they get in office, they act like they're on retainer to those who bought their way there. And they do nothing to change our system. When's the last time you heard anybody from Utah's congressional district saying that we needed public financing, we need strict limits on campaign contributions, we need to overrule however possible, even if it takes a constitutional amendment, this perverse case, Citizens United, and now this most recent Montana case, where the Supreme Court has said in a 5-4 decision that corporations can spend unlimited amounts of money during elections to change the result. We are living in a plutocracy, government by, for, and of the very wealthy, and the people have been completely ignored in the process. Republicans and Democrats alike seem to have no concern anymore for civil liberties, for human rights. Now we have a Democratic president that's engaged in the most subversive, anti-American kinds of things, including the targeting of U.S. citizens for assassination without any semblance of due process, signing into law, and he asked for the powers, and then he signed into law the NDAA, which granted the powers for our government to essentially kidnap people, disappear them, put them away indefinitely. It could be up to the rest of their lives without the right of habeas corpus, without legal assistance, without charges, without a trial. I mean, this is like Gulag America. In fact, gulags may have been better because at least there was some pretense at times of bringing charges against people, at least letting them know why they're being put away. In this instance, there don't even need to be charges. And it's so bad, most people will not believe that this has really happened in the United States of America. So this is worth fighting for. And we need to face the fact that, first of all, this is not a team sport. Just because it's your side that's in power and is doing this doesn't mean that it's right. So we need to put principle ahead of partisan party affiliation and say we're not going to put up for it anymore. Mm-hmm. As good patriotic Americans who believe in our constitutional values, who believe in due process, who believe in the rule of law, we've got to say no more. Even if you're a Democrat and we have a Democratic president, you've got to be able to draw the line and say, I understand what's going on, and we're not going to put up with it anymore.
We are talking with Rocky Anderson, former Salt Lake City mayor, now presidential candidate. He's doing this outside of the major parties, as you've been hearing some of the reasons there. We're also joined by USU Associate Professor of Political Science, Mike Lyons. I don't know, Professor, if you have a question for Mr. Anderson?
Well, I certainly share many of the mayor's concerns about the health of our political system and the power of campaign finance in our system and the power of entrenched special interest groups. There's no question about that. I guess I believe a movement like the National Popular Vote movement is a constructive way of attacking some of those problems, and it may seem roundabout, but the way to restore the power of the average person in the United States is to get that person more engaged in the political process. And the Electoral College, as it currently elects our president, is very detrimental. It's a giant neon sign that says, don't bother to participate. And getting more people to participate and having a better national dialogue over important issues like how we conduct a war on terror, quote unquote, which I think is a fallacious concept from the get-go. But you know, we need a much more vigorous national debate. We need a much higher level of civic engagement, and the power of entrenched special interest groups will diminish if we can increase the offsetting power of the average middle American.
And I completely agree with everything that was just said, but we've got to attack it from every angle. We're never going to see these reforms in our government as long as Republicans and Democrats are in control of the system. We need to get other people in positions of public policy making so that we can make these kinds of changes. But these folks are benefiting from the Electoral College. You're never going to see people who benefit from the system give up those benefits as long as they're in office and thriving from it. The incumbents, look at the power of incumbency and the kind of money that these people can raise. And in terms of engagement, I have lamented the fact that people in this country have been so complacent for so many years in the face of these major abuses and illegal wars of aggression and all the rest of it. But I think part of it is, first of all, the education that they're getting and the sense that they have no power because everybody's just bought off. I hear it all the time. I go to Occupy sites, for instance, and there is such cynicism. People saying the electoral system's completely broken, everybody's bought off. Why should we engage? And I think that's perhaps the most dangerous thing that we're facing right now, because if everybody would stand up and say, we're not going to put up with this anymore, we could together change the direction of this country.
I think many people share your point of view. I think the question becomes, and obviously you've answered it by your actions, can such change be truly effected from outside the two-party system?
It has to be, because the two-party system is now a one-party system. And when we talk about the duopoly of the Republican Democratic parties, look at what they've done to make it so impossible in so many states to even get on the ballot. It takes a multimillionaire like Ross Perot or a bunch of multimillionaires that came together and spent $15 million collectively in the Americans Elect effort to get on the state ballots. We're doing this as a grassroots operation, and we cannot get on the ballot in several states. I mean, California, 1,030,000 signatures on the ballots, and they set January 3rd as their deadline for parties to get on the ballot. We just prevailed, by the way, a couple of weeks ago in federal court in California in having the court declare that deadline unconstitutional. We're filing suits in Hawaii, in Vermont. But who can do this? I mean, you come down and look at our operation. You know, we're running with a bare-bones staff of people who are horribly underpaid, way overworked, a lot of good volunteers around the country. But, again, money ends up controlling. And then if you do get on the ballot, you don't get on the stage during the presidential debates because the two parties hijacked the debate process away from the League of Women Voters, and they created, the Republican Democratic Party created the Presidential Debate Commission, and they control it lock, stock, and barrel.
We are running out of time, just have about a minute left. I just want to ask you what's next for the campaign. The website is voterocky.org, I believe.
Yep, and we really encourage people to get involved. Go to our website. You'll find it probably the most substantive website out there, and we've also got some great videos that have been done by volunteers. And I just say get involved and say no more to the duopoly. Send the message that you're no longer going to stand for this corrupt, perverse system that has betrayed all of our interests.
If you'd like to comment on anything you heard, go to our website, upr.org. We have a comment section there. We'd love to have your comments. Rocky Anderson, former Salt Lake City mayor and presidential candidate, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And again, the website is voterocky.org. Tomorrow on the program, we are going to have a very quick turnaround reaction to the Supreme Court healthcare ruling, which we expect, hope very much, because we built the program around this, will be coming out at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. We'll have Judy Hillman from Utah Health Policy Project on. We'll also have Norman Thurston from the state. And we'll have a couple of legislators who are on the health task force for the legislature. And we hope to have your response as well. That's tomorrow on the program. USU Associate Professor of Political Science, Mike Lyons, thanks for coming in again.
Happy to be with you, Tom.
And thanks for listening to Access Utah.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.